Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 26th of July, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, of course, Mike Robinson. And we're delighted we are joined today by Alex Thompson, bringing us Eastern approaches from the Netherlands.
Summer's back.
I was just going to say, yeah, summer's back. It's raining, very misty in Plymouth today. And I'm going to say our support and commiserations to the people who've organised local agricultural shows, because they were setting up yesterday in hot sunshine. Today the rain's come in, but if we look on the bright side, of course, cooler is better for the animals seeking their first prizes
in the show.
In the show, yeah.
Right. Shall we start off with secret courts?
Secret courts and shadow government is where we're going today, I think.
Yeah, secret courts. So over the years, Brian, we have highlighted instances of secret court hearings, much to the annoyance of certain fact-checking sites such as Full Fact. A perfect example of secret hearing, Melanie Shaw, who's had hearings held in secret in the sense that the hearings weren't listed publicly. On top of that, she's had hearings held where her attendance was by video link, and that video link disconnected at critical moments, leaving her excluded from her own hearings. And the hearings proceeded without her, as far as I'm aware. That's correct, isn't it?
That's correct, yeah.
There's another even more insidious version of secret justice in Britain, if that's possible, because while Mel's problems are a breach of, they're in breach of the regulation, so there's a possibility that they can be dealt with. There's a largely unknown issue of special advocates, and this one, well, it's carrying on openly and largely unchallenged. So the role of a special advocate, according to the government, has developed in proceedings before a wide variety of forums, both statutory and non-statutory in origin. These are the government's words, where a party, with the permission of the forum, seeks to rely upon closed evidence. Closed evidence may raise issues concerning national security. Individuals and their legal representatives are excluded from hearings where closed evidence is used. Got that so far?
Certainly have.
Right, okay. Special advocates perform an important role, this is the government's words again, by representing the interests of the excluded party in those hearings and subjecting the sensitive material to scrutiny, thereby promoting fairness in the proceedings. So let's just understand this. People who are subject to court proceedings where there's a decision to include closed evidence, those defendants are not entitled to see the nature of the evidence. They're not entitled to rebut the evidence. A third party who may or may not know anything about their case goes in and represents them. I guess somebody who's been security vetted.
Isn't this the old Soviet system, Mike? Probably Alex is the man to comment on that, but it seems to me this is the way you do it.
Well, let's move on and we'll run through this. Now, Justice, the pressure group, I say mostly unchallenged, largely unchallenged, but Justice produced this 2009 report on secret evidence. And they said that special advocates special advocates, however, are not the cause of unfairness in proceedings. Rather, they are merely the most common and most visible symptom of the unfairness caused by the decision to allow evidence to be withheld from the defendant. So people have been commenting on this. It hasn't had a huge amount of media coverage. And then in 2012, 50 special advocates, either serving or former special advocates, submitted this memorandum to the Justice and Security Bill, on the Justice and Security Bill to the Joint Committee on Human Rights. And they said that closed proceedings, well, let's just have a look and see what they said. We remain of the view we expressed in our response to the consultation and endorsed by the Joint Committee on Human Rights that closed proceedings are inherently unfair and contrary to the common law tradition. So this is the position of the various people discussing this subject.
And significant, Mike, that the expression common law has appeared in that. Very significant.
Absolutely. So why am I mentioning this today? Well, because the Attorney General is seeking to appoint new members of his panel of special advocates. And the special, so just to explain what he's saying. The special advocate competition is open to both self-employed barristers and solicitor advocates with at least 5 years advocacy experience. But he wishes to recruit advocates at the junior level, in particular those with expertise in family and employment tribunal work, and completed applications must be submitted by noon on the 18th of September. Now, I can see, Brian, that in the case of a terrorist trial, some people may take the view that there's national security issues at stake and therefore perhaps some evidence needs to be heard in a closed court. But I, for the life of me, cannot work out how this is appropriate to the Family Law Division. Well, it can't possibly be about divorce. So this must be about the taking of children.
Well, this is absolutely it. And I come back to the case that we are mentioning, a case which is taking place in Sheffield. We're not able to give details of the case. But what we can say is that where there has been video and audio evidence of a child being abused, that evidence is simply being shut out of court. So therefore, there's no case. And the other thing I'm going to say is that evidence from around the country, it doesn't matter whether it's Scotland, Wales, Oxford, Cornwall, of the use of the psychiatric system to silence people who've got evidence of child abuse, that is being used as a template. So use of the psychiatric system, preventing people seeing evidence against them in court. I'm going to come back. This is the Soviet-style system. And this cannot be an accident. This must be deliberate policy that's being brought in. Alex, give us some comment on this, if you will, please.
Brian, as this is family law, which isn't even a proper branch of English law, it's been invented recently as if it had other rules of conduct than other branches of law, which it doesn't. This is family law, so it is not proper national security issues. It's not signals intelligence by the proper agency, GCHQ or MI5, nor is it human intelligence by the proper ones, MI5 and MI6. It is actually a way of covering intelligence which has been perpetrated by councils, perhaps by private firms, hired by councils or individuals within them. And this, of course, is unlawful enough, but we've had a succession of so-called Investigatory Powers Acts since the Blair years by both Labour and LibCon and now Conservative administrations. So that's the stuff that's being covered. I'm reminded of David Scott's coverage of East Lothian Council, which has a snooper's charter, as it were, which involves council staff being told to create Facebook identities or to hang on behind false ones to spy on people whom they intend to steal children from. So that's the kind of level we've got to here. There's a fundamental sleight of hand here with advocates coming in. Scots law, of course, has an advocate. That's just a barrister in English law or an attorney in US law, the same term, someone who pleads for you in court as a professional member of the Bar Association. But in English and Welsh law, there is no such thing as an advocate as a formal job title. So the space has been left free for effectively a Marxist commissar to take that role, to plead on behalf of children or of the concept of social interest or of the council, so that you've got these invisible partners, as it were, these invisible men in court besides the defendant and those who are accusing him. So deeply un-English and fundamentally illiberal.
Illiberal, and I'll just remind people again, what we are seeing is that where evidence of the abuse of children is coming to the surface, particularly where that evidence relates to establishment figures or politicians, then the objective, first of all, or the tactic, first of all, is to attempt to brand the witness, the person coming forward with that evidence, as having some form of mental health issue. And we know of several cases where people, with the connivance of local authorities, the local mental health teams, of course, and the police, have simply been put into psychiatric units on the basis of accusations that they're somehow mentally ill. Mm. This is very, very dark and sinister activity, but it is happening in Britain today, I believe, to protect the government.
Okay, let's move on to Grenfell. A couple of days ago, we mentioned the Independent Recovery Task Force. Sajid Javid has now announced details of that. And has listed the people who are going to be serving on it. Now, the task force is going to look at whether the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea has the proper arrangements in place to engage with local community on their long-term recovery plans. They are going to apparently ensure that all immediate housing needs are promptly addressed. They are going to support the council to significantly improve housing management. And they're going to make sure the council develops, in partnership with the local community, a plan for the Grenfell Tower site and to ensure that the right leadership and governance arrangements are in place across the council. Those words are their summary in the press release. But when I looked at the actual terms of reference for the task force, it also mentioned that they were going to look at the situation with the TMO itself. So here's what Sajid Javid had to say about this. He said, "I am determined that everything possible is done to support the local community following the disaster. This includes ensuring an effective recovery plan is developed that takes into account the views of the local community. The new task force has extensive experience in this area and will provide the council with the expertise needed to deliver this important work." Well, that's all very good. It's taken a little bit of time. Maybe this is the start of some progress. Now, of course, as we've said before, Kensington and Chelsea is going to be taking the lead on the recovery from the fire. The task force is there to provide some oversight. So who's on this then? Well, the first person on it is Aftab Chugtai, who is chair of the West Midlands Police Independent Advisory Group. Then we've got Javed Khan, chief executive of Barnardo's. We've got Jane Scott, who's the leader of Wiltshire Council, and Chris Wood, who's a partner at Altair Housing Consultancy and a former director of housing for three London boroughs. So I thought we'd have a look at some of these. Now, we've only had a chance to look at a couple of people here. So here is Javed Khan, Brian. Working for a charity doesn't make you an angel, he says. Guess who he's writing for here?
I'm going to stay silent because...
Well, Common Purpose.
Oh.
Isn't that a surprise?
Probably not, Mike.
So Javed Khan, chief executive of Barnardo's. Apparently, Barnardo's runs 1,000 services in local communities and is the fifth largest charity in the UK. He previously was chief executive at Victim Support. Before that, executive director at London Youth Violence Board. I've got to thank a couple of researchers. Thank you very much for your help on this morning. He was chief executive of Victim Support, and they say that they help over a million victims and witnesses each year, having 600 sites across England and Wales. So that's good. The next person on the list was Jane Scott. Well, it turns out that Jane Scott is, in fact, Baroness Scott of Bybrook, who is a Conservative Life peer. So she's in the House of Lords as a Conservative peer.
But she's just named as Jane Scott, isn't she? She's an ordinary member of the public.
Absolutely. So Conservative leader of Wiltshire Council since its formation as a unitary council. So I just wondered, has she got any leadership skills, Brian? And in no time at all, I discovered that she's actually a leadership mentor for the Clore Foundation, for the Clore Leadership Trust. We can see her listed there on the list. She is a mentor.
So this is another very, very elitist group of selected leaders. And I remember coming across this organisation quite a few years ago after they attacked me for my early reports about Common Purpose. Well, so they were very aggressive in trying to... stop me reporting about Common Purpose.
Well, that's hardly surprising, Brian, because Common Purpose is one of their partners. So already two of the four of the task force are Common Purpose leaders.
Yeah.
And we haven't had a chance to look at the others in depth yet, but this does not fill me with enthusiasm for the job that they're going to be doing.
Not with enthusiasm, but I think we can be encouraged here that it's becoming ever more easy to see how the government puts together the cover-up team. We can perhaps bring in here as a further example that after the initial report on the deaths in Staffordshire hospital, and that was a very good report, and it certainly did take the lid off. The government brought in a new team to effectively rewrite that report, and they even called the team the Common Purpose Team. So I think we know what we're seeing here. This is the groundwork being established for a massive cover-up.
Yep.
Okay.
Where are we on to now? Alex, we're moving on to defence, and you wanted to highlight this one, that Japan is linking the defence, Japan inks a defence deal with Germany amid China threat. Japan and Germany have signed an agreement on the joint development of new defence technology. We're seeing more and more of these defence pacts coming into place, but what's your reading of this?
This is, Mike, part of what I would call the undoing of the post-war order, which we're seeing in the economic frame with Bretton Woods. Well, it ran one generation on the gold standard and then a second on Middle Eastern oil being the backing. And now that's falling apart and the Bilderbergers are in turmoil. The same is happening on the military front. So we've noted that the Germans are suddenly getting interested in fighter jets, which they were not supposed to build. And they're doing so through Franco-German leads. But here we see that Japan, you would have thought that the West would have learned never to allow Germany and Japan to team up again, but here we go. Japan and Germany are going to cooperate closely, and particularly with Britain. Now, the Japanese have already signed similar bilateral pacts of the kind that we see being the core of the EU military union. So the French and Germans have each signed a number of these pacts, but so have the Japanese with France, Britain, the United States, and Germany, and the Netherlands I see here as well. So all the usual suspects. And the particular focus, because the US have not been wanting to sell or share most of their military technology for air-to-air missiles and the kind of things that the Japanese would really want against China, is that the Japanese are actually developing the MBDA Meteor. It's an active radar missile, air-to-air, which is being led by British companies, according to this Deutsche Welle, German official overseas news article, with significant input from German companies. So right there in an article about Japan, we see that German companies are getting very close with the UK defence sector, which is exactly what David Ellis has been saying. And at the back of this, I suspect Hitachi, which is getting its tentacles everywhere, will be very involved in some of the technologies. This missile is going to be kitted out on the Eurofighter Typhoons, including those deployed by both the Royal Air Force and the Luftwaffe. Is there any separation anymore between the Royal Air Force, the Luftwaffe, and Japan?
Well, apparently not. No, but what we're seeing, Alex, just to reinforce this point, aside from the bilateral defence agreements that are happening within the EU, which are leading towards the EU military union, we're seeing bilateral defence pacts amongst a whole bunch of other countries around the world. This is a really important point, and I want people to keep that in mind as we go on through the programme, because we'll be coming on to this issue of bilateral agreements a little later. Now, Alex, last week we mentioned the issue of the alleged border changes in Georgia, an accusation against Russia that they were attempting to move the border. Apparently the border signs, well, you tell us what's going on here, because Tbilisi is contradicting media reports.
Now, this could be read as a sign of the Georgian government's rapprochement with Russia after years of headbanging against them, which culminated, of course, with Saakashvili invading South Ossetia in 2008. But anyway, the OC Media is one of the latecomers to the Georgian media scene and pretty respected as one of the English language sources, and it goes back to Georgian sources as well. But it is the first time, Mike, that the Georgian government has actually said, no, the claims being made by our own hotheads are wrong. So they're reining in their own propagandists, who are usually New York and London trained, for the sake of proper relations with the South Ossetians and ultimately the Russians, who are guaranteeing South Ossetian autonomy and peace now. So you recall the footage of these advanced green signs being put in the middle of people's fields, and this sort of rent-a-farmer characters turning up on camera saying, I've lost 10 acres of land or whatever. Well, even Tbilisi, the Georgian government under Prime Minister Georgi Margvelashvili, has now said, actually, no, that's not the case at all. The date was wrong, as reported all over the place, that no one lost any land, despite the pictures you saw of a farmer hidden behind barbed wire and fire and the media the other side. So it was, as you noticed, Mike, it was one of these very quick popping up media talking points to bash Russia with. And we see the Russian border encroaching in Georgia, too. But for the first time, even the Georgians have backed off. So I think we're losing some of our proxies out in Eastern Europe.
Bashing Russia being the theme, and Russia starting to bash back, perhaps because this video clip that you're highlighting here, Sergei Lavrov bashing back. And if I just read a couple of this, First of all, Keir Simmons is working for which media outlet?
Keir Simmons is with NBC, National Broadcasting Corporation, when it used to have its full name, which is one of the major US mainstream outlets. But he started off with ITN. He's their polished, presentable Brit for big interviews. But he also does showbiz people as well as politicians.
OK, so Keir Simmons had said to Lavrov at the G20, when the two presidents are meeting, apparently President Trump's wife even came into the room to say, we need to wrap this up. But it was going so well, they wanted to continue. And Lavrov said, look, our political and human culture does not provide for someone else's family matters to be discussed in public. And you've said here that he was pretty exasperated as he said that. And then Simmons goes on to say, but my question is really more about, and he's cut off, and Lavrov saying, I understand you're British, you're too eager to get more details than Russians can provide you on this human rights subject. So getting a bit annoyed, and then Simmons went on to say, you don't want to share more about what happened. It was a 2-hour meeting and we know very little about it, really. And Lavrov said, you asked about the First Lady coming in and I answered you. And I think the 30 minutes or so that we have been talking, we've been discussing mostly the meeting in Hamburg. What is your specific? And then he is cut off and Simmons says, on Syria. Do you view the reports that the CIA program to back the Syrian rebels in Russia has been stopped, that the program will no longer go forward? Do you view that as a concession to what Russia is asking for in Syria from the Americans? So a quick change of subject. And Lavrov said the decision was taken as far as the American media is concerned. And in brackets, if you can still believe the American media, but I still try to.
So he's getting in several digs there, both at the NBC network, which is one of the mainstream ones in America, and at the British journalistic tradition, which has always provided a useful front for the American attack dog media, because the Brits are held to have more polish and panache at asking this without just sounding grinding and whiny like some of the East Coast US journalists do. But Lavrov is onto this with his flawless English and has put his finger on the problem. Mainstream British journalists just want the tattle and the personal juice, and the Russians are not going to give it to them. And I've seen that Helen in the chat box has said poor Lavrov because she's read the whole interview, which is available unadulterated on the Russian Foreign Ministry website, bilingual, by the way, if you don't want to read the NBC version or watch their version of the video. But it really was a grilling for Lavrov because he said at one stage, I feel as if I'm here in the United States Senate hearings about Trump's collusion with the Russians. So he knows what the game is.
Yeah, he's a capable guy, though.
Oh, he's the world's most experienced foreign minister by a long chalk. And even 9 years ago when he was dealing with us in an expletive and explosive phone call with David Miliband, who was then our foreign secretary, he said, I'll remove the expletives. He said, don't you try to tell me what to do. You know, he more or less said, you're a kid in short trousers compared with me. Yeah. So he's not going to be messed around. And he's also trying to deal with the US confiscation of Russian diplomatic residences on the Bayshore in Maryland and in New York State, where they used to send their diplomats to recover from the swampy Washington, D.C. climate. Those have just been seized contrary to international law with police guards. And Russian media has now shown that the lights are on, but nobody's home, as it were. There seem to be literally spooks in those properties doing who knows what to the Russians. Diplomatic assets. So very dangerous times, really, in Russian-US relations, despite the appearance of Donald Trump on the scene.
Yeah.
Well, where can we go from that? I think we can come straight into the fact that British press and media are not reporting the true facts about the state of the British military. On one hand, we're told we should be very fearful of Russian foreign policy, the Russian military. But let's do a little bit of a recap on what some of the reports have been to do with the size of Britain's military. So here we are with 2016, the Mirror, one of many articles, Army short of 2,000 troops as recruitment firm Chaos drives away soldiers. Well, let's bring us up to date with 2017. Army fights troop shortfall with new recruitment ads about camaraderie. And what's causing the problem? Well, the problem is that recruiting has gone from army recruiting sergeants and has been put in the hands of this company, Capita, which we all know and probably don't love for its tactics in extracting the TV license from people. But ever since the company's had the contract, things have got worse at the very time the government says that Russia is a growing threat. This is another article from a few months ago. Britain's armed forces are shrinking by the day. And does it really matter? There were some very good statistics put across. Of course, the big spike in the military there was the First and Second World Wars. But you can see on the bottom scale from the 1950s onwards a decline. But what senior military officers, retired officers, are now telling the UK column is that the situation is dire. The army in particular incapable of mounting a serious campaign. And we say that Michael Fallon, Defence Secretary, is simply trying to grab the limelight with his new aircraft carrier, Queen Elizabeth, which unfortunately does not have any aircraft. So his Capita, what do they say? That on defence they're addressing the financial challenges that the defence sector is currently facing, partnering and outsourcing. And they're really, they've become a compelling solution. Well, they're a compelling solution if the aim is to destroy the military. But I was fascinated by a little bit of the language in here. Let's have a look at this. It says, we understand that in future, the first choice for UK defence manpower capabilities will be the whole force approach, WFA. WFA is a flexible workforce construct for defence that will enable the delivery of military outputs in the most efficient and effective way, blending military, civil service, regular reserves, sponsored reserves and contractors. So this is newspeak, Mike. What I think is going on here is the military is being dragged into a morass of different agencies so that nobody knows who's the real military and who is not. And what we can expect is further trouble. Well, where's this policy coming from? Well, this is one man responsible. This is Capita Defence Partnering Director John Clokey. He says there's a £60 billion funding gap. Industry can help the MOD in ways to address this gap and give it the flexibility and agility to procure whatever it needs to deal with whatever threats defence has to face. So there's a £60 billion gap, but he says my company, Capita, can solve all of those problems and deliver whatever's needed.
Well, he's clearly some form of wizard or magician or something.
Magic circle. So I went just to have a look at this man's experience. He was originally Capita education specialist. He was helping Britain's schools. And then he suddenly moves across at the top of the page there to Capita Group Defence. What's his claim for defence experience? He's done a few years of part-time work with the Royal Navy Reserves. So interestingly, at the top of his LinkedIn profile, he says he was educated at the Britannia Royal Naval College. I find this just unbelievable. We have a part-timer who moves from education to defence and now he's advising the British government on a £60 billion black hole. This is nonsense. These are the sort of statistics that the papers have talked about, but they're not following the story. What we say is the forces have been cut because this has eased the UK military into the unified EU military system, which was the objective in the first place. This is very dangerous, Alex. Just very briefly, we don't know whether we're dealing with government or the civil service, or we've got some profit-making global corporation that is supposedly running our defence?
Well, Capita and other such companies like Omnia, which are more legal-focused, are very dangerous because they start off in one area and gain trust. It was educational services about 15, 20 years ago. They started taking on interviewing for jobs in schools. And then they moved into Capita RAS, recruitment advisory services for local government. And before you know it, they're running the councils. And then they say, on the basis of this so-called success, let us run some even more hardcore trusted, cannot fail stuff like the military and the police. And I see from a comment in the chat room that right where you are in Plymouth Sound, one of our viewers recently saw a frigate sail out of the Sound with no flag flying at all, which I think is contrary to certainly military flag codes. But it turned out when the viewer looked up the number to be a Dutch frigate. So the suggestion there is that the crew may have been there for Capita training. It's all a bit of a whirl, and before we know it, the unified EU Navy is going to be under this Capita control.
Absolutely. Thank you, Alex. Well, let's just briefly mention that AV8 DVDs, for anybody that wasn't able to get to Ian Crane's Alternative View conference in May, those DVDs are available. They are now shipping. The special offer price is only available for a few more days. It ends on the 1st of August. These are going from the UK Column shop, so please get your copy if you would like to.
And can I just add into that? I think the talks were all good, but for me, the talk that really made me pay attention was a gentleman who spoke about Albania. He described the complete destruction of Albania from a poor but happy and working country to a country that was effectively being run by Tony Blair and Sherry Blair. So if you want one sales point for buying that set, the Albanian talk of an hour was truly exceptional, in my opinion.
Absolutely. Now, Alex, a few minutes ago we were mentioning all these bilateral defence pacts. Yesterday I mentioned that Liam Fox had been travelling to the States to discuss hashtag Global Britain and global free trade deals. And if you remember, this is what he said, as Adam Smith famously observed, free trade appeals not to one's benevolence, but to the idea that prosperity is achieved when we are at liberty to pursue our own interests. So I was highlighting some of the dangers of what he's up to. And I was commenting on the BBC downplaying what he's up to by sort of bringing it to the level of chlorinated chickens. And I have to say, Alex, that as I've watched the social media response to Liam Fox's trip, this is the issue that people are focusing on. It staggers me in a way that the campaigns that were being run over TPP and TTIP have more or less been forgotten. And as these bilateral trade agreements are being created, at least talk of bilateral trade agreements being created, what is being created is, instead of the two or three Uber trade deals, is a mesh of bilateral trade deals, which will amount to exactly the same thing. And I have to admit, Alex, I don't really understand why people aren't recognising this.
Well, it's the old tactic, isn't it? I'm sorry if you can hear a motor revving outside. There's a lorry just parked up here. But it's the old tactic. If you get seen too much in the framework of large supranational organisations and global deals, then go for civil service to civil service deals, because the networks are there in place anyway. As we've seen in the example of Capita, they're often trained by the same institutions. We're going to come onto one of the bodies of our Foreign Office that does the same thing, trains foreigners and reframes their minds. So it's very much more difficult to keep track of, because people can see and fear a beast that calls itself the World Court or the World Trade Organization or whatever. But if it's called Global Britain or forging successful trade deals with dynamic economies, then we go to sleep, don't we? It sounds a bit less threatening, because we forget that the same networks are running it and the same ideologies.
Yeah. OK, well, let's move on to Viktor Orban. What's he been up to?
Viktor Orban, the Hungarian Prime Minister, has an annual tradition of going to the ethnic Hungarian area of Transylvania, which is in Romania on the map. And he gives a speech every year there to young people in an open university format. And a couple of years ago, he gained wide attention geopolitically by saying Hungary is no longer in the liberal democratic mould. We've seen that liberal democracy ends up with welfareism and subversion. So we're moving ahead of that into a country that works. And that's our new paradigm. And this year he's gone further than that. And perhaps you can read out, Mike, some of what he said. We're actually going to start with the answers to the questions which he took from students after the talk itself. But this is of genuine interest, I think, to our viewers, what he said about Brexit.
Well, he said, on Brexit, I'd like to tell you that I don't share the negativity which is prevalent in Brussels today and that sees the United Kingdom as an enemy. Many people think that we must now prove that a country can only be worse off outside the EU than inside it. I believe that this idea is complete nonsense. It's for every nation itself to decide how it can best serve its own interests inside or outside. And if they decide that it would be better for them outside the EU, they must be allowed to pursue their interests outside. And so I reject the linguistic dichotomy that's been offered to us, that there should be either a soft Brexit or a hard Brexit. The withdrawal process and agreement we need should be a fair and just one, even when it's no longer a member of the European Union. The United Kingdom will still be our friend.
So you can see, just by being one of the Central European EU member states heads of government who says that we are going to be friendly with Britain and we're not going to try to cabbage Britain during the Brexit negotiations, he's rather let the cat out of the bag about Merkel and Macron there, hasn't he? And it was also be worth pointing out that he was sitting on stage there, as the previous slide showed, next to a hero of the removal of Marxism from Europe, Bishop Laszlo Tokics, who people might remember in 1989 was the clerical leader of the uprising in Timisoara, as it's known in Hungarian, Temeswar in Hungarian, Romanian is Timisoara and Hungarian Temeswar. He was the bishop who actually rose up against Ceausescu. So this bishop has now been invited on stage, and the reason people haven't heard about this great hero who largely helped overthrow Marxism in Europe is because that bishop has gone on to take the same view as Orban, that nations are more important than supranational government and globalism. So they've both been sidelined together.
Well, you produced this list of Orban's themes in a speech. So let's just run through this very quickly. So his first point is, what makes a nation great? He said a great nation bothers to show up for the next generation by reproducing. He said a great nation collects corporation tax and uses it to encourage parents to have many and happy children. He said a great nation takes revenge on anyone worldwide who harasses its citizens. A great nation can decently host any of the world's great events and boast splendid architecture. A great nation has strong armed forces. And then he also discusses what is solidarity. He's saying here, solidarity is not wanting Brussels to steal yet more sovereignty from one's own national government. He said solidarity is not paying Germany five times as much as Hungarians for the same job at the same efficiency. He said solidarity is not embracing ideologies that seek the destruction of Europe, and that solidarity is not an end in itself, but merely a means to peace, security, freedom and prosperity. He said that solidarity is genuine, mutually agreed defence. And he said that solidarity is paying the Hungarians what they've spent on protecting the EU from invasion by George Soros. And finally, he said solidarity is Hungary and Poland sticking up for each other to stop the Grand Inquisitor picking them off. Who's he referring to there?
He's referring to the Eminence Grise, which every European Commission has, because it's based on French politics. So you'll remember in the monarchic era French government, there was always the Eminence Grise behind the throne, often a cardinal, which is why he was called the Grey Eminence, wearing a grey habit and so on. And in the last, he names them by name. He says in the last European Commission, it was Viviana Reding, the awful attack dog from Luxembourg, who was always going on about the British needing to change their ways. And in this commission, he says, under Juncker, it is Frans Timmermans, the supposedly Anglophile and very arrogant Dutchman in the commission, the number two, who again savages not Britain anymore, but the Central Europeans who are daring to recover their national sovereignty. So he's worked out that even the EU only has the resources to pick up one country at a time. And if he clings on to Poland in the ancient alliance they have going back centuries against Turkey and Russia, then there's no way that either of them can be brought down.
Yeah, OK, well, look, we're going to move straight on to Poland because we're running out of time rapidly here. And Poland is in a constitutional turmoil, as you've described it here. Just briefly, what's at the heart of this constitutional problem?
It's not very clear-cut, but basically the government's line, which is the governing party, is called the PIS party, Prawo i Sprawiedliwość, Law and Justice, and that's Mr. Kaczynski's party. They're arguing that there is a communist hangover in the Supreme Court and that they need to be able to control who sits on the Supreme Court, which, by the way, is exactly what the US government has with its famed separation of powers. It still has presidential nominations to the Supreme Court. Britain is the same. And yet we have the gall to tell the Poles that if they allow the government by a statutory change and a constitutional change, if they allow the government to appoint the Supreme Court justices, this will be a great step back for the rule of law. So people can freeze that slide that was up a moment ago and they can then read the New York Times. But the main point I would say about that is that they definitely don't like Mr. Kaczynski here. Well, there's things not to like about him, but they're colouring up the language. They're falsely accusing him of having seized the lectern. He did say, "You lot murdered my brother," which you can talk about in a moment, Mike. But he did say that. But he certainly didn't seize the lectern. He just walked up politely and said his piece. in rather impassioned tones.
Well, Alex, I have to say that the tones were impassioned, and it was a bit more than politely, because it wasn't very polite language that they used. Now, of course, what we have on screen here is the protests outside, and so what seems to have happened is that they then ended up in Parliament in a midnight discussion about this, so as it says here, somebody brought up the issue of Jarosław Kaczyński's brother, Lech Kaczyński, who died in the 2010 plane crash, and Kaczyński didn't take that very well. We have a little bit of video here showing that, but basically his language was colourful, to say the least, not the sort of thing you would expect to see or to hear in a parliament, where he basically swore quite, he was quite firm about this. Take your damn snouts, what did he say? Do not wipe your damn snouts with the name of my brother.
Yes, that was it. Don't wipe your damn snouts with the memory of my dead brother. And then he added, you murdered him, you scoundrels. And that made its way into the New York Times report. You can see that the government benches are standing up to applaud there. And if we watch this clip through a few more seconds, the speaker of the Sejm, S-E-J-M, the Polish parliament, saw that the former prime minister, now in position, this lady, was waiting to speak. And she ended up saying, this man's lost his mind. But there was so much chanting going on in the Sejm at this point in the midnight hearing that he started tinkling his little bell, the speaker, which you can see there. And in about 3 seconds, yes, the clapper has fallen out. That's how hard he had to tinkle it.
Yeah, it was a real shame. Okay, Brian, let's move on to the, or sorry, Alex, let's move on to the BBC, because Guido Fox here saying the BBC making a Foreign Office documentary. And your question is, will the BBC be making a documentary about the Foreign Office, or is this in fact the Foreign Office making a documentary about the BBC? So you're hinting here that in fact they are the same organisation.
Yes, and more particularly that the FCO has much more knowledge of the BBC than vice versa. The BBC is going to have to take it on trust from the FCO handlers making this documentary that things are as they say, and you ought to look here. This is the most interesting part of the building. So obviously the FCO's jargon and way of doing things will rather overawe the BBC programme makers, and the FCO has a long history of being able to manipulate media because of the mystique it has and the idea of being the most elite branch of government. So I think in the end we're going to find the BBC being used as a channel here, not for us to find out about the FCO, but for the FCO to tell us what it wants to know about itself.
So where does that take us, Brian?
Well, where that takes us is, what is the Foreign and Commonwealth Office? And I'm going to bring in Wilton Park and thank some of our viewers for sending in information. We have mentioned Wilton Park before, but today I think it's time to take the lid off it. So let's just have a look at this one. This is the website. They seem to be very excited about a plane there, Mike.
The F-35,
indeed.
Looks like,
yes. That one is flying, but it could be a virtual plane. But what is this organisation? Why should we pay attention? Well, have a look at the website. Have a look at what they talk about. And, of course, they're saying that between 1946 and 1948, more than 4,000 arch-Nazis and officers from the Wehrmacht were reframed. They were reprogrammed. How do we know this? Because one of the gentlemen himself said he was a Nazi. He came to Wilton Park and it changed my life. It's almost like a statement out of common purpose, isn't it? It changed my life. So we're just going to say, how was this done and who did it? And we're really keen for some information on this. But here's two names, Heinz Köppler and Herbert Sulzbach. And these are two key men from Wilton Park. We went for a little bit of information from the Jewish Chronicle here on Herbert Sulzbach. And it says here that he fought for Germany in the First World War. He then came out of Germany prior to the Second World War, ended fighting for the British. But somehow he gets involved in what was happening at Wilton Park. And he is one of the key people that apparently changed the whole mindset of these strong Nazi individuals. So it says here, subsequently working amongst the high-ranking SS officers in prison at Featherstone Park in Northumbria, Sulzbach ensured that these more hardened candidates also returned home with a clear understanding of how liberal democracy should work. So that's a really interesting statement. What liberal democracy were they talking about, Mike? Not too sure about that because of the people who were involved at the beginning, like Bertrand Russell.
I'm not aware that he was a massive proponent of liberal democracy, more technocratic than liberal.
What about Lady Astor? She was also in there.
Difficult
to say,
no,
isn't it?
No.
Well, our point here is, who are these people and what are they up to? Have a look at some of the information from the website. Prime Minister Edward Heath and the French President Pompidou agreed that issues concerning the enlargement of the community should be addressed. So that's Wilton Park into the EU. This is interesting. 1997, Wilton Park holds its first meeting in Switzerland on the United States of Europe. And on it goes, NATO, anywhere there's action, they're talking about it. Here's Slovenia, Sweden, Serbia. We've got Abdullah Gül, Republic of Turkey. So anywhere there's trouble in the world, Wilton Park's discussing it. And this is interesting. We've got a memorandum of understanding being signed with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Republic of Turkey. So you say, how did Wilton Park do that? Another memorandum of understanding signed on behalf of Wilton Park by British ambassador to Brazil. All fascinating. 1955, following public debates in Britain, Germany, the government decides that Wilton Park should continue to be largely government funded. So this is not some sort of side NGO. This is an arm of the government. And this is the key. In 1991, Wilton Park becomes an executive agency of the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. So, Alex, to answer your question here, once we're into Wilton Park, we're not sure who we're dealing with. But if we have a look at some of the people, just extraordinary. We've got Peter Apps. He's in PS21. This is going to change the world. They're looking at studying the 21st century. We've got neuroscience and philosophy. Down here, we've got John Holmes, chair of the Electoral Commission. That's pretty interesting, isn't it?
Very.
Very interesting. We've got this one, Michael Lee, senior fellow, German Marshall Fund of the United States.
And of course, the German Marshall Fund, as we reported a couple of days ago, of the United States, has just launched this new neocon initiative to ramp up the angst over what they allege to be connections between Trump and Russia and Russian interference in the US election. And in fact, trying to bring this global, because they're saying that the Russians are trying to interfere in European elections as well. So that's a major program of the German Marshall Fund for the United States.
Fascinating. Then if we come down here, we're back into UK government, the UK Department for International Development. We've got a lady working on digital health. And we just go back up to Mr. Nicola Koloff here, executive director of the Argideus Foundation. They're convinced that inclusive economic growth is one of the primary drivers of change in low-income countries. Our work is inspired by Catholic social teaching, and the Argideus Foundation is a Swiss-based charitable foundation. And it's working alongside this organisation, which I really encourage people to have a look at, because lots of pictures of children in that one. So here are the key staff members. We've got Marl Wickstead. We've got Joe Childs, Ellis Maddox, Director of Finance, Kirsty Coburn. Oh, dear. She just happens to have come from BBC Media Action. So we're going to leave you today saying, when did we ever elect these people? 30 seconds to close, Alex.
That Argideus logo was rather interesting, wasn't it, Brian? I suppose if they're a Catholic organisation, they would claim it's a reference to the stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. But it looked rather more to me like the capstone of a pyramid being winched into place to oversee the lower orders. I'm afraid there's a lot of this going on, not so much in the FCO itself, but Wilton Park's a good example, in the kind of tentacles which feed in and out of the FCO, Chatham House, Wilton Park. And I've seen plenty of promising young diplomats from various countries go to one of these conferences and come away a very different individual. So it's a real danger.
A real danger. Thank you very much for that, Alex. Well, there we are. We've taken an alternative look at what's really happening in UK world politics today. We say that the UK and probably the US are being driven by shadow governments. We need to expose who those shadow governments are and what their true objectives and loyalties are. Thank you very much to all our viewers and listeners who've been sending in information. If you're saying some of this should be researched, some of this should be put into a video, then we say to you, perhaps you are the very person to take on that role, as we can only do what we do so far. Thanks for joining us today. We'll be back tomorrow at the same time. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.